today on Vox Talks Economics. How should governments respond when a warming world hikes food prices? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research by Nate Timtonix. Every week, we bring you the best new research in economics. Remember to subscribe. Follow us on Instagram as well.
Right now, almost entire India is feeling under this heat wave. More than 15 states have reported temperatures hitting more than 40 to 45 degrees Celsius. Especially the northwestern state of Rajasthan and Gujarat are at more risk of this heat wave because these states are going to face temperatures crossing 50 degrees in the coming days.
March 2022 was the hottest March in India since records began. It was also exceptionally dry. There was nothing that government could do to lower the temperature, but on 13th of May 2022, it responded in an unexpected way.
India banned wheat exports with immediate effect on Saturday. This comes as a severe heat wave in the region has reduced the output of the world's second largest wheat exporter, driving domestic prices to an all-time high.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the US ambassador to the United Nations, urged India to reconsider, particularly because wheat supplies were already disrupted due to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Or in reply, India's representative to the United Nations, T.S. Tirumurti, cited food security and rising prices to justify the government's actions.
Defending its decision to ban wheat exports on the global stage, India on Wednesday voiced its concerns over global food insecurity amid an unjustified increase in food prices.
We are committed to ensuring that such adverse impact on food security is effectively mitigated and the vulnerable cushioned against sudden changes in the global market.
But outside India, many still worried that what might be good for India's citizens would be a disaster for the global poor in other countries.
Look at this. I mean, we've got a 5.2% increase in wheat prices in the last 2 days. Does it mean that further upward pressure is likely to keep on being piled on agricultural commodities?
Well, one could say so, Richard. Yeah, I think definitely. We've already seen global food costs at a record earlier this year, and the chances are they're going to keep on going higher.
Analysts say the ban could now drive world food prices to new peaks, given the already tight supply, which would hit poor consumers in Asia and Africa especially hard.
So how hard were those consumers hit? Today, we're going to discuss how common this type of policy intervention has become and what are the consequences of export bans for governments and trade, consumers and farmers. Alan Shao of Stanford is one of the authors of new research that provides some answers to these questions. And when I caught up with him recently, I first asked him about why the Indian government thought it necessary to impose this ban.
Well, what happened here was in March, just a couple of months before this export ban, there was this massive heat wave that struck in the breadbasket region of India. And the direct negative impact of this heat wave was to reduce wheat production that ultimately led to about a 10% reduction in expected output. And as is very natural in economics, if the domestic supply falls, then the domestic prices rise. And we know politically that high food prices can be a problem for governments. And so then the Indian government responds. They respond by stepping in with an export ban. Our paper is focused exactly on this kind of trade policy response to climate shocks.
For this export ban, what justification did they give for it? Who were they trying to help here?
Well, the broad idea with an export ban in general is to keep domestic supply in the country. And the logic is as follows. If you keep domestic supply in the country, you keep domestic supply high. If you keep domestic supply high, then you can keep domestic prices low. Low domestic prices are good for someone. They're good for customers, consumers. They're meant to keep domestic consumers happy because, of course, those domestic consumers need to eat. And so the motivation here comes down to a question of national food security.
So they're the winners, hopefully, for the government. Who are the losers from this? Who else is affected?
Well, the key here is that Low domestic prices are good for domestic consumers, but they're bad for someone else. They're bad for domestic producers. As a wheat producer, an Indian wheat farmer, you want to sell for a high price, not for a low price. Without government intervention, the farmers are going to suffer from the production losses, but at least they're going to get higher prices on what they actually do produce. If you do have government intervention, then now the farmers are suffering doubly, both from low production because they get hit with that climate shock, but they also get hit with the low prices that are the result of what the government has done. At the same time, if you look at a global scale, you can also think about foreign consumers who are also going to suffer from this Indian export ban. High domestic supply means low foreign supply. Low foreign supply means high foreign prices. High foreign prices are bad for foreign consumers. Foreign consumers suffer.
So did it work in the way that the Indian government wanted it to? Was it popular?
The policy did help. It had its desired effect. It helped to manage domestic prices by keeping them from spiking too much following the heat wave. And we also see this side effect of higher foreign prices. In terms of the political picture, in terms of domestic popularity, we do, of course, also see the divided opinions. Again, the export ban was good for consumers, but domestic producers weren't happy. The New York Times actually interviewed an Indian wheat farmer around this time, and the farmer says something like, look, if the price wants to go up, then just let it go up. Who, the farmer asks, is the government trying to protect at cost to Indian farmers?
And looking globally, are interventions like this one becoming more common?
Yes. The short answer here is yes. It is a common kind of policy. It may be getting even more widespread in its application. We see that this kind of agricultural trade policy isn't just limited to Indian wheat. We see many other examples in the year 2023, palm oil in Indonesia, rice in India and Myanmar, olives in Spain and Turkey, onions in Kenya and Tanzania, potatoes and tomatoes in Morocco, and the list goes on. We often see governments trying to manage domestic food prices.
Also in May 2022, Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, warned that the war in Ukraine would tip tens of millions into food insecurity. So, on the 20th of May that year, we spoke to Guido Porto and Bob Rikers about who was suffering and how much from food price inflation. Look for our episode, The Food Crisis Has No Respect for Borders.
As you say, the list goes on, and you've investigated the impact of these policies. Did you just focus on India for this research, or other countries as well?
Other countries as well. We put together a new global data set to study these policies worldwide. We're broadly interested in whether this Indian example for wheat holds across countries, across crops, and also over time.
So to do this, first of all, you need information on how all weather is affecting the production of all crops everywhere. Where do you get data like this? How granular can you be?
We really benefit from some fantastic temperature data from ERA5, which comes from the Climate Change Service of the European Union's Copernicus Program. These data are fantastic. They're very granular. We have 0.25 by 0.25 degree measurements. That's a resolution of about 31 kilometers by 31 kilometers. And not only are they geographically granular, they're also granular over time, and they go far back. These measures are available hour by hour, going back several decades, actually. We take the temperature data, we combine it with data on crops, where different crops are being grown, how these different crops are differentially sensitive to extreme heat. And so we end up with a data set that allows us to lean into variation even across crops, even if we are looking just at a single country and a single year. We have that variation across crops within country year.
Wow. You also need, on top of this, to characterize the policy responses. So who collects data like that?
We also are going to benefit from rich policy data that come from the World Bank, and in particular, the World Bank's Distortions to Agricultural Incentives project. This is some really pioneering work, ultimately, by Kim Anderson and co-authors. The data set that this team puts together covers 80 agricultural products and 82 countries from 1955 to 2011. That's more than 85% of agricultural production globally. And others have worked to update this data set, and we use some of the updated data as well. The main policy variable that we're interested in and that we work with is called the nominal rate of assistance, and what it represents is a percentage gap between domestic prices and world prices. That is to say that if the effective domestic price is much lower than the world price, then that's going to suggest that the government is using policy to keep domestic prices low. Again, good for someone, domestic consumers, but bad for someone else, domestic producers.
Out of this, what is the average change in food policy in response to domestic heat shocks like we saw in India? And can we estimate this as a change in domestic consumer prices?
To think about quantifying these impacts and these average changes, what we look at specifically is the effect of experiencing high extreme heat exposure relative to experiencing low extreme heat exposure.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, we can think about exposure at the fourth quartile, the top quartile of severity, relative to exposure at the first quartile, the lowest quartile of severity. And what we find in that example is that exposure to high versus low leads to a reduction in the policy variable, that nominal rate of assistance of 7%. Now, what does that imply? That implies a 7% reduction in domestic prices relative to the international price following a domestic climate shock. Let me say it again. That is, in response to a big domestic climate shock, governments move to push domestic prices down by 7%, helping the domestic consumer but hurting the domestic producer. We can also focus on a smaller set of the 10 major crops, where we find actually a much bigger effect of 29%. And we find that this result is driven really by trade policy, which we can replicate with direct measures of trade policy, like tariffs and import-export restrictions.
Okay, that's response to domestic shocks. What's the response if the shock occurs in another country?
What we find is exactly the opposite response.
That's right.
When the shock occurs in trade partner countries. And this is just because the mechanism is operating through trade. We're focused on trade policy responses.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, suppose your country is a net exporter, like India for wheat. India exports wheat on net. If you receive the shock, if India receives the shock, then you produce less, so you export less. You have less to sell abroad. If your trade partner receives the shock, then they produce less. They have less production. That means they need to import even more from you, which means that you can export more. So what's the upshot? The upshot is that you export less when you get the shock, but you export more when they get the shock. Opposite trade patterns, opposite trade policy responses.
So why are the governments doing this? Is it strictly for economic reasons, or is it really political because it's popular?
We do think that politics are at play here. We do think that the politics are important. And in fact, in the data, we see that our result is even stronger in election years and the years also just before election years. Mm-hmm. These are the times when politically it is important not to burden consumers with high domestic food prices. This is the time when politicians are sensitive to managing domestic food prices. And more broadly, one of the main points of our paper is that agricultural trade policy like this, like the export ban in response to a domestic climate shock, this kind of policy is fundamentally redistributive, and redistribution is something that we know is deeply political.
You've also investigated the welfare effects of these policies. What impacts are you trying to trade off here?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're interested in welfare effects. And to get at that, we have a simple quantitative framework that's going to allow us to evaluate these welfare effects in equilibrium worldwide, in the aggregate. And so what does that mean? Well, we're going to look at impacts on consumer surplus, on producer surplus, and on government revenue.
Mm-hmm.
Noting again that the main trade-off for a domestic government is that when they step in after a climate shock with policy and with a policy intervention in order to keep prices low, that trade-off is that it's good for domestic consumers, but bad for domestic producers. More than that, we're going to evaluate welfare globally. And so we're also going to quantify those spillover effects on foreign consumers and foreign producers. We can look at partner countries that trade with the country that received the climate shocks.
Mm-hmm.
We can also look at bystander countries that themselves do not receive a shock and also don't trade with the countries that got the shock. And we can quantify the spillover impacts on these foreign countries as well.
So bundle all this together, and what are the aggregate welfare effects that flow from these policies?
In terms of those aggregate welfare effects, well, we look at first the historical data, focusing on the period from 1991 to 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And what we find is that trade policy responses to climate shocks almost fully stabilized prices in those markets that got mm-hmm. the climate shocks. That stabilization via government policy of domestic prices is going to serve to reduce the losses to domestic consumers by 97%. Why? Because the government has stopped the domestic price from going up, and so the domestic consumers don't get hit by the high domestic prices.
Yeah.
But because the government steps in to keep domestic prices low, the losses to domestic producers are going to be worsened, and in our simulation, it looks like worsened by 55%.
Right.
Now thinking about the foreign side, the policy is also going to exacerbate this spike in world prices, and what that leads to is losses to foreign consumers that are increased by 105%.
Gosh, that's a big number. If we wanted to discourage national governments from enacting policies like that, is there any feasible way to do it?
It's an important question. It's also a difficult question. We see our paper in many ways as a first step in quantifying the global impacts of these kinds of trade policy responses to climate shocks. And of course, that's going to be useful, our quantitative findings in particular, for informing policymakers who might be considering these types of policy interventions. But at the same time, it is harder to think about policy at a global scale. Why? Because we know that international coordination is just difficult in practice. But there could still be a role, perhaps, for international organizations like the WTO here in this context.
And if these interventions continue to happen in that case, and we get more extreme weather events because of climate change, is that worsening the impact of climate change?
We're definitely interested in thinking about the impacts of climate change in this paper. We extrapolate out of our historical sample to quantify those welfare impacts of climate change projected by the end of this century. And in this scenario, what we find is that these trade policy responses worsen total welfare losses by 14%. Now, the takeaway here is not so much the specific number of 14%, but rather how it illustrates the mechanism at play here. We're projecting policy responses that end up magnifying existing trade distortions. In this projected scenario, climate shocks happen to hit places with distortionary trade policy, and it's pushing those governments to make that trade policy even more distortionary. Climate shocks are exacerbating pre-existing distortions in trade policy, and that's going to end up augmenting the welfare losses that we see in this projected scenario. But to also take a quick step back and think more broadly about climate change and the impact of trade policy responses to climate shocks, we know that governments regularly intervene in markets. We know that governments regularly intervene in agricultural markets in particular. Climate change is going to make these policy interventions even more salient. And so we think it will be hugely important for us to really understand how these policies respond to climate shocks, as well as the welfare impacts that these policy responses are going to have.
Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
The paper is called
Food Policy in a Warming World is published in 2024 as a working paper. The authors are Alan Shao, Jacob Moscona, and Kartik Sastry.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. Next month, November, it is COP29 in Baku. So follow us, because in the run-up to that, we will be bringing you more episodes focusing on the questions and the policies that will be discussed there. But before that, next week on Vox Talks, young, educated and unemployed.